Welcome to the Six Figure Speaker Spotlight, the podcast where we uncover the secrets of CEOs, entrepreneurs, and visionaries who've used public speaking to skyrocket their businesses and their bottom line. Get ready for captivating stories, valuable insights, and practical wisdom from the trailblazers who've mastered the art of the stage. I'm your host, Kelly O'Hara, and I'm thrilled to bring you their experiences and expertise directly to you. Let's get started. Welcome back to the Six Figure Speaker Spotlight, the show that pulls back the curtain on how powerful public speaking can catapult your message, your business, and your legacy. I'm your host, Kelly O'Hara, and today's conversation is going to crack open a different kind of success story. This isn't about flashy exits or overnight hype. This is about building something real, something that lasts, while staying fiercely loyal to your values. It's about weaving faith, vision, and culture into the bones of a business and using your voice to lead with purpose, not just profit. If you've ever looked at your business and thought there's more here, but I'm not the one to take it the rest of the way, this episode is going to feel like it was made for you. Today, I'm joined by Andrew Galpin, redemptive entrepreneur, culture builder, and founder of Tree and Leaf Partners. Andy is on a mission to acquire and steward one great business, not to flip it, not to gut it, but to honor it, to protect the founder's vision while scaling its impact. His journey is anything but linear. From starting a web business firm as a kid in the UK, to strategy work at IBM, to theological training in Uganda, to summiting Himalayan peaks and earning an MBA from Kellogg, his story is simply a masterclass in purpose-driven leadership. Now through Tree and Leaf Partners, he's searching for a company whose heartbeat is still strong, but whose founder is ready to pass the torch. If you're that founder, or if you just want to learn what it means to lead with conviction, integrity, and a whole lot of courage, this Spotlight episode is for you. Andy's here to talk about culture design, servant leadership, and why storytelling is more than just branding. It's the engine that powers transformation. So let's dive in. Andrew Galpin, welcome to the Six Figure Speaker Spotlight.
Kelly, that is such a wonderful introduction. As a British man who's used to being introduced simply by my name, that makes me blush. So I'm very delighted to be here and excited to share with your listeners.
This is going to be a joy for me. You have such an incredible energy. I love your story. I can't wait to share this with the audience. You've really taken quite a winding road, from building websites in the UK to tackling theology in Uganda to launching a search fund in the US. If you zoom out and you connect the dots, what's the thread that's always pulling you forward?
That's a great question. For me, when I reflect back on all those different experiences, the common thread is using technology to solve problems that matter in the world. So whether we go all the way back to those high school days where I was creating websites with a colleague of mine from school, and we would go out into the local community, this was before everyone had a website, and we go, wouldn't it be better if this video rental shop had an online presence so people could find it in a different way? Wouldn't it be better if this local charity had a bit more visibility so they could showcase the great work that they were doing? And we would use technology to solve that problem of visibility and awareness for people in our local community. And it was just a real pleasure to do that and to be part of solving that problem that really mattered for those people.
Was there a moment or a conversation or even some kind of breakdown where you knew the traditional career ladder, it's not your path, and something more meaningful was calling? Was there anything like that was the catalyst for you to make the move? I love these stories.
I would say so. And it came a bit later in my career. I did engineering in my undergrad studies and spent a year working for a small engineering firm. And that's where I came to the revelation that despite studying engineering, I didn't want to be an engineer. I didn't like how narrow the problems were that I'd end up solving, whether I'm focused on testing something or building a circuit or designing a kind of whole product. The idea of doing the same thing over and over again didn't really sit comfortably with me. So I then pivoted out of a small business into a very large business And I went into consulting for IBM, helping our clients design more meaningful experiences for their customers and employees. And I tell you, Kelly, I really love that work because it was diverse. We solved lots of different problems. I got to move between industries and take insight from one industry and help apply it in a different industry. But I reached a point in my career with IBM where I was like, I'm giving advice, and the client has three options of what to do with that advice. They can ignore it, which is always heartbreaking. They can accept it and still do nothing, which is almost more heartbreaking, Kelly. Or they can actually do something about it and drive the change that we've identified and want to see in that organization. And I worked out that consulting as a career path in that conventional corporate environment was never going to give me the ability to drive that impact and change in an organization and really reshape an organization for those people, because I never would sit in that decision-making seat where I could drive change and drive accountability. So that took me from the UK and all the way across to the US to do my MBA, to really solve that question of how do I keep all the things I really enjoy about the work that I do, but introduce this element of ownership and accountability and being able to drive change in the organization that I'm working with.
So this is really where you got the moniker that you're the redemptive entrepreneur, I'm guessing. What's that really mean to you? When you realized that was the type of impact that you were meant to make, how did that change things for you?
For me, it was a combination of I felt called to lead like Jesus would in the workplace, because when I looked around at both the workplace and whether it's the government and politicians, I saw what I would describe as a crisis of leadership. Yes, there were good leaders in the workplace and many of them were not very visible. But unfortunately, a lot of the most visible leaders that we find in society are not the best leaders and don't represent the best interests of their people. So I felt a burden for that, to respond to that. And part of how I did that was doing a master's in theology to dive into kind of how do we think about some of these ethical questions we have to answer in the business environment. And then going on to study my MBA to how do we build out that foundation of business knowledge that means we're making the best possible business decisions as we go. But I got more and more frustrated. There were two things that really drove this idea of redemption to me. And the first was this idea that profit at all costs was the right way to do business in the world. And I saw a lot of companies prioritizing profit, but not necessarily thinking about what the long-term impact of that was. And how do we drive society towards a better place while making profit at the same time? The second trend I noticed was both at IBM and at business school, I was surrounded by people who in general didn't enjoy their jobs. And that amazed me. I was like, why would you spend 40, 50, 60, 70 hours of your week doing something that you really don't enjoy? And then when I went to business school, I was like, all these people have identified this challenge. They don't enjoy the work that they're doing. So they're looking to pivot into something else. And the number of people I spoke to that were planning to move into careers, they already knew they weren't going to enjoy, just amazed me. And I was like, why are we building these companies where people don't even want to work at, but money has become the main driving factor and the main force of value in people making those decisions? What would happen if we built a better company, an organization that valued human beings as people rather than just line items on a balance sheet or a P&L? And that's where the idea of redemption comes in. And I use that language. It comes from an organization called Praxis that have a redemptive business playbook. And they view business as a driver of positive change in the world, that we look at the problems in the world around us, and business is a really effective tool to enable us to solve those problems and resolve some of them. And a lot of companies, our default state is to extract from the world, it's to take from the world, whether we're looking to drive profitability by increasing prices and squeezing our customers, or reducing costs by putting pressure on our suppliers to reduce the cost of our raw materials. We're exploiting from the ecosystem around us. And there are many companies that are being intentional of trying to counteract that through an ethical mindset. How do we do this in an ethical way? And how do we do this in a right way? But I find those two are more of a balancing force. And we find the problems in the world don't necessarily get better when we're just balancing that exploitive and that ethical framework. We need leaders to take a role in society to really think about how can I be intentional about shaping this organization to solve a real problem in the world. So when my employees go home from work, they're not tired, exhausted, and frustrated. They are invigorated and they can go home and share that energy with their family and have a great evening. So we can view human beings as more than just a cog in the ecosystem of e-commerce.
Such an exciting perspective, and one that whose time has come. It makes me think of a friend of mine who went to law school and spent 10 years going after becoming partner. And of course, that was the big goal. But once you get there, you find out, wow, I'm trapped now. Like, I've invested all my money, my time I could have spent with my kids, my wife, everything. And now what am I going to do? Where am I going to go now? I don't even like this work because it's all based in negativity. No matter what lawsuit you're in, on both sides, there's misery. You're just dealing in buckets of misery. You really epitomize that Will Rogers quote that I love so much. Find what you love to do and you'll never work a day in your life. It's about loving what you're going to do. If you're going to spend hours and hours doing this, money is not enough of a trade-off. It just isn't. I have been in that trap before where all of a sudden you're making really good money, but you can't get out because it won't translate exactly across. And you think, wow, but I've been doing this for a long time. Now I want to do something different. It's not easy to make that jump. So I really love what you're doing. So you've worked in tech and faith-based spaces, and you deal in corporate strategy, you got your MA. What surprises you? What has come, did you find out that surprised you the most about the difference between success that looks good and success that feels right?
For me, I think success, as the world puts it on us, tends to be very financially driven in terms of value. So we're focused on kind of the salary that we make. The owners I talk to, they're focused on the check they get from selling their business. And we're very focused on the financial outcome. And we forget to think about the other sources of value in our life and how important they are to us. So a lot of the coaching I do with owners who are thinking about a transition and trying to work out if we're the right fit for them is, what do you value? What's important to you? Because if your employees are really important to you, if them having a long-term career at your company is really important to you, then that's worth something. And that might mean you don't sell your business to a strategic or a competitor that's going to give you the highest price, because what they're going to do is, Anne from accounting will no longer work for you. The sales staff, they've already got their sales team. They'll also disappear after about a year. And the reason a company can pay more is often because they're crossing out items in your P&L and going, I don't have to pay that cost because I already have that in my business. And when I bring them in, they can be part of my broader organization. And that's a good outcome for some companies. And that's the right outcome for some companies, but not for all companies. And if you care and value about what happens to your employees, you need to think about, what am I willing to accept and what cost am I willing to pay in order to receive that value and maintain that in the long term? Another element tends to be the culture of an organization. If you invest a lot in training your employees or having really generous benefits because you really feel that's important to you and your organization and an essential part of your culture, what is an acquirer going to do? Some of them are going to look at that as an extra cost that they don't really need to be paying. And some people don't understand and value the importance of culture and how each of those different elements are what makes up an organization and what makes it successful. So a lot of the times, companies will spend a little bit more buying a company like that. They'll remove all those benefits that made the employees loyal and it made their work enjoyable. And then those employees leave anyway, and the organization folds, or it merges in with something else and becomes a very different entity. So again, if you value that, and if you think that's valuable to you as an owner, you need to put a price on that and be willing to accept a slightly smaller check in order to retain that and find the right partner who's going to steward that and look after it.
Oh, I just love this. It really brings a new conversation to your exit strategy, how you want to leave what you've built. Even if it's time to go, you want to retire, you've done this long enough. I love your focus on the employees, because really what you're saying, this is what you've built. You needed people to build what you have that you're not now able to sell. do you want to leave it intact? Because you're right, they're just going to rip through it because they don't have the relationship there. You've talked about before, in my research, you talk about honoring the founder's original vision. We got a world right now that's really obsessed with disruption. Why is preservation with purpose such a radical concept, do you think?
I think it's radical because it's not how we've operated in the world for so much time. And the US particularly has been very successful in a capitalistic system. So we're used to growth and growth at all costs being the main mindset and driving factor for us. But we're starting to see the cracks of when we start to extract from both the earth and the planet and from the people around us and our customers. And when we have a very short-term vision that the public markets tend to drive. I remember listening to IBM's quarterly earning calls, and you are accountable every quarter to exceeding or at least meeting your estimated earnings. And if you don't do that, your value goes down, investors sell, and that's a negative reaction in the market. So it doesn't incentivize really long-term investments and making the best decisions that are going to drive those outcomes. And that's why I always find it interesting speaking to people who work for IBM 30 years ago versus people who work for IBM 10 years ago. And it's a world of difference in how they describe that company and the journey it's been on. And not all of it's bad, but some of it is headed in a direction that's a bit more quarterly driven in terms of driving profit and making sure we're achieving that.
I really appreciate your perspective. I know right now this could be an interesting topic to bring up, but Elon Musk, who I have watched for quite a while now, and you have the opportunity to go and listen to his board meetings, appreciate him for how he looks at each of his companies. What is the impact going to be in the future? I'm solving this problem for people now. How will this develop and how will it serve the future? And I really appreciate that perspective. I've listened to those board meetings with really fascination of how open and connective he is. And it would be great if other companies work like that. I know right now you realize very quickly he's very focused on managing expenses and running a tight business, et cetera. But this is a brilliant collaborator as well that really is very inclusive. Inclusive really appreciates team. And I think that's why he's been so successful globally, is that he really knows how to think very much. It seems to me takes in a lot of the values that you're talking about. At least that's my experience. That's my experience of him. So it's interesting watching him operate right now.
Yeah.
And watching how he moves through the space.
He definitely has a purpose in mind for each of his companies. Whether you agree with that purpose or not is up to you. Different kind of sides fall on different arguments. But SpaceX, the mission is to get to Mars and to build a kind of a place that we can move to if Earth becomes unviable. So that's a very long-term purpose. And that drives the decision-making of that organization in a very healthy way, I would view. Now, whether you think we'll end up on Mars is a different question. Hopefully we'll do a good enough job that the planet stays in a livable condition as we go through that. But there's a real purpose around that. And that also unites the whole company around being part of something bigger. Because the big challenge with the Industrial Revolution is we went from I make a car end to I put a socket on a small part of the car. And it's very difficult for me to feel like I'm connected to the purpose of the organization when all I'm doing is this every day.
Yes.
It doesn't help me connect with the vision. So we as leaders have to be very good at articulating what's that vision? What is the purpose of this organization? And then how does each and every person and their very different roles in this organization connect with delivering that purpose? It's like the janitor at NASA who described to the president who visited, I am helping put a man on the moon. And because he keeps the environment clean, that's exactly what he's doing. He's part of that broader purpose. And they have there's a study on kind of janitors in a hospital system. And if we renamed them from janitors to medical assistants, because that's essentially what they're doing, they're assisting the medical staff in keeping the environment clean and sanitary. And by doing that, they drive better outcomes for patients. And suddenly they're much more motivated around the job that they're doing because they're not just cleaning floors, they are creating a safe environment for people to get well again. And that purpose is really inspirational and motivational for people to be part of that organization and stay in the organization in the long term.
Such a basic human need to be noticed, to be included, and to be noticed for what you do, to be seen is a better word to say. I think that's why we do the work we do. It really isn't about the money, because if you have three jobs and they all pay the same amount, Is it that you want to be entertained at work with the work that you're doing, that you're turned on by it? But also, am I going to be recognized for the value I bring to this company, to this venture, to this, to the purpose that I'm aligned with? I love your idea. I love what you're talking about with the janitor. And if you just change the title, you right there, that's such a bump to feel like you see me and what I do has value. And imagine whether it's NASA, let's say you're working for SpaceX and they're planning on going to Mars and they won't get there for 20 years, let's say. But along the way, guess what? You're just part of rescuing astronauts that were stranded in space. I'd feel pretty proud to be working for SpaceX. I think I'd be pretty excited about it. And I'd feel like part of the purpose. So purpose is so important, and I think it's what keeps us connected. But again, it's about being seen. You want to be seen in your relationship with your spouse. As soon as people feel like I'm invisible, I've become furniture in this relationship, it is time to move on. It is time if you're invisible. And it's the same with work. So tell me about the story behind your company's name. I love the name Tree and Life. I love that. I just think it's terrific. And what is Tree and Life and Niggle?
So Tree and Leaf Partners, it's named after a collection of short stories written by the English author J.R.R. Tolkien. So well known for The Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit,
Yes.
and most people have interacted with him in some way. But he wrote this little collection of short stories, and one of the stories he wrote was called Leaf by Niggle. And this was a story he wrote after The Hobbit was finished, but before he wrote the trilogy. And what Tolkien was trying to capture in that story is the immensity of the task he felt was ahead of him. And it took him over 30 years to actually write the trilogy. Most people write a book in kind of 6 months these days, or a year maybe, but it took him 30 years to get through that. So he saw this as a big task and a big vision. And the Niggle story is about a painter called Niggle that has a vision for a leaf. And he's a really good painter of leaves, but he wants to paint something bigger. So one day he has this vision that goes beyond the leaf. It's not just of a leaf, but it's of a tree where the leaf sits in. And it's not just a tree, but a forest where that forest resides in. And it's not just a forest, but a valley with mountains and a sunset and a beautiful vision that he sees in his mind's eye. And he starts painting out this vision, but he gets interrupted by all the things of everyday life that get in the way. And eventually, death comes knocking on the door, and it's time to transition on. He never gets to finish that painting. And for me, when I read that analogy, I really connected with that's what I want to do for someone holding that paintbrush at the moment. They have a vision for their business that maybe started as a little leaf, and it's grown maybe into a tree or maybe even a forest. But they know there's much more behind that still to do. There's a bigger impact to have. There's more of this purpose that we need to connect with and deliver on. And rather than shutting down that business or selling it to someone else who has a very different vision, what if they pass that paintbrush on to someone who took the time to really understand the vision, the values, and what's driving that company forward? And they could continue painting out that vision and that picture. So the company could continue having the impact even when they start to step away. And you can look at it from the outside and see not necessarily the finished piece, because I like to say a business is never finished. We're always growing and changing and having a different impact in the world. But you get to see that picture emerge from your original vision, even when you've taken a step back.
A fabulous story and metaphor. I won't ever forget that. I think that was exquisitely told, but that's one that will stick for me. I really love that. I thank you for sharing that. Now I have to go read that book because I certainly was a big fan of his series and read it and watched the movies over and over again. I just think it's fantastic.
You and me
So
both.
tell me something. You're actively looking for one business to acquire. Why just one? What's the strategy and the heart behind that kind of decision?
My skill set lies in growing and scaling a company. Some people are really good at startup phase. Some people call that 0 to 1 or 0 to 10, where you have to be quite messy and you have to keep changing things until you find the right fit in the market, and then you're ready to grow and scale. That is not me, Kelly. I would get so frustrated in that environment. For me, my background at IBM was always coming in, bringing clarity to a convoluted process, refining it and helping it grow and scale. So that's the skill set that I bring to the table to help a company grow and scale. So acquiring an existing company is a much better fit for me than trying to start something from scratch. I also believe that culture is really important. So I'm looking for companies that have already invested and been intentional about building something great, but want to protect that moving forward. And there are so many small businesses in the US and so many baby boomers who are running those businesses that will eventually need to step down and step out. And I want to protect what they've built and what they've spent 45 years building and investing in their organization to make sure it continues to grow and flourish. So I really connected with that idea of solving a problem for someone that needs to transition out, whether they want to retire, they want to play golf, they want to spend more time with their kids, or they've just reached an age where they know for that company to live on and be successful, they need someone else to come in and bring some new energy to that environment. So for me, it was around connecting with that vision and having the opportunity to impact and shape an organization, because I've been part of a workplaces that I've loved and I've been part of workplaces that I haven't loved. And life is too short to not enjoy the work that you do.
So true. Nothing is worth doing a job that doesn't bring you pleasure or purpose, hopefully both, and safety and vision at the same time, security and vision at the same time. There's so many elements to it, but I love your passion for this. And you can tell this is your lane. I can see your lane. It's so clear. Let me ask you, when did public speaking become part of what you do? Because you've spoken on stages from IBM, obviously, to Uganda, to Pakistan. How did those experiences shape the way you lead and communicate?
I'll tell you a story, Kelly. When I was maybe 12 or 13, I used to sit about 2/3 of the way from the back in drama class, because I knew if I sat too close to the front, I might get picked. And if I sat too close to the back, I was also too obvious, but 2/3 of the way back, I was hidden and therefore wasn't forced to participate in that kind of way. The idea of standing up in front of people and talking was very frightening to my younger self. And it wasn't until I went off to university when I was part of a local church down there and a pastor saw that gift in me. He felt that the Lord was speaking to him and he saw some kind of inklings of a gift of public speaking within how I operated and how I led in that context. And he invested a lot of time and a lot of space in giving me the opportunity to try that out, both in just speaking to myself and speaking to him and trying to be confident in that, but also on a small context, maybe with a group of 20 or 30 people and helping them connect with what the Bible says and how to apply it in their life was the context that I was working in. And you know what happened as I did that and as I built up confidence, Kelly? I started to really enjoy it. And I uncovered something that was a real strength of mine and a real asset that I didn't know I had, because I'd never been willing to step out that comfort zone. And I don't think I would have ever done that if someone hadn't offered that hand and lifted me up into that and given me the opportunity to try that and test that out. So I had many opportunities to exercise that over my career after that. But that was the real inkling and the foundation of discovering that gift.
Isn't that such a fascinating thing? This is such a good piece of this conversation, because sometimes it takes someone else to see something we cannot see in ourselves. I had the same experience. Terrified of public speaking, absolutely terrified. And it was someone else. And they ran a magazine, a Bible in the industry that I was in, who said, I really want you to do this. My first reaction was, never going to happen. I would never do this. It was a huge event. And I remember that I got put into the position because of where I was working at the time and had to do it. And it's interesting when people can see you from a different light, because you only see yourself from the inside of your skin. You know how they say you can't read the label from inside the jar, and you don't see it. But then you end up going out there and you manage to have impact, or you have a good experience and you realize it's not as horrendously horrific as you think it will be. And then you find out, wow, I was supposed to do this and I had no idea. I would never have known if that one person didn't say, we need you for this, or I think you are going to be fabulous at this, or whatever that is that says, all right, I'll show up. And really, most of life really gets down to showing up. You'll figure it out when you get there. And I think that's one of the things I want to share with people about speaking, is that you only regret what you don't do. You never regret what you do. If it didn't work out, okay, maybe I don't want to do that again, or I need to get better at it, or it could get right down to, I suck, we won't be doing that again. But it's an answer, and you went out and addressed the fear. But if you don't do it, you'll always wonder, you'll always regret it. And we don't have room for those kind of regrets. It's better, go ahead, take the chance. It could turn out to be something amazing. I know it did for me, but it sounds like it's turned out to be a gift that you have. So I love that. How has public speaking helped you build trust, whether it's with founders or investors or future team members? How has it impacted your life that way?
Public speaking, if you remove that fear, then it gives you some natural confidence. And even if you feel that fear inside, you portray confidence by being able to speak well and articulate clearly in those kind of contexts. And I remember a great piece of advice my father gave me before I walked on stage to do a talk. He says, you should always feel a little bit of fear. If you don't feel a little bit of fear, you're overconfident, but you shouldn't allow that fear to be crippling. So that's always sat with me. And that is really helpful because that fear isn't going to go away. I even get nervous before coming on your podcast, Kelly, because we don't know what's going to happen. We don't know what questions are going to ask. And it's all very exciting. And I can do all the preparation I can in the world. But until you actually do it, feel the fear and do it anyway, you don't have the opportunity to really test that out. So it portrays confidence. I would also say there's an opportunity to connect with people in a very different way. I like to say human beings are narrative beings. We think in stories. So public speaking is a great opportunity for you to share a story and help people connect with the emotion of you in that situation. And by connecting with those emotions and feeling the feelings that you've felt, that helps build trust and credibility with the people that you're talking to. And that can be on the stage in front of 1,000 people, like I did in Pakistan, or it can be in a team meeting, kind of sharing a story and helping people connect with that to build trust quickly. And I think particularly in our virtual world, we build trust a lot faster in person because we can pick up on our different reactions and adjust on how we're connecting with other people to make that optimal. Inside our little boxes on a screen, that's much, much harder. So by taking some of the tools of public speaking and being intentional about how we're using them when we're in virtual contexts like we are today, that gives you an opportunity to build trust much faster. And everyone leaves the conversation feeling in much closer and in a much better place with that relationship than they went in because you've been intentional about cultivating that environment.
It is about being intentional. And you're right. It's great to see someone on stage. And the audience really is for you. You find universally, the audience is for you. Half of them are just so glad you're doing it and they're not. And they are, that anticipation is, okay, I'm ready. I'd love to hear what you have to say. That's a really nice position to walk into. What I love about virtual, and yes, it may not be as good as person to person. It's different. But I find this to be a very intimate platform. I don't take calls anymore. If I can avoid it, I don't want a phone call because I want the dimension of being able to see someone and look in their eyes. And I feel like when you walk out of an experience like this, you feel like you know the other person, that you have a good feel for them. You've seen them, whether they're bobbing and weaving or whether they're really clicked in, you have a chance to really have a feel of what their energy is and a sense of their real intention. I think that's beautiful. I'm a big proponent of Zoom. I appreciate what they've done pivoting during a tragic time, really horrific time with COVID. They were able to pivot and build out something that serves the world and has brought us all together globally. It's a piece of cake to speak to people all over the world now. Thank you, Zoom, for leading the way in such an exquisite way. I'm just really impressed. So do you believe that using your voice from the stage is a leadership skill that every entrepreneur should develop?
100%. Yeah. Whether you are actually on the stage or not, the skills that you need to be a good public speaker are so useful in every aspect of leadership. If you're talking to your teams and you have to gather them around the purpose or the vision of the company, you've got to be persuasive in how you do it. So they're the same skills, persuading an audience of 1,000 that your ideas are right, to persuading your people that your vision is correct and they want to be part of being on board and solving that problem and being part of using their skills to solve that purpose. So there's lots of skills that we can take from public speaking and practice through public speaking that then make us better leaders in other contexts, even off the stage.
Love it. I love it. So back to your business. Let's say you're dealing with a founder who's really poured their soul into a business, but knows it's time to step back. What's that first conversation with you actually look like?
Yeah. Depends. If they've made that decision to step back, that's often a hard decision to make. And they're in a really good place if they've reached that stage. A lot of the conversations I have with owners, they're still holding on a little too tight. So they haven't yet recognized that need to let go and release what they've made into the world. But if they've reached that stage, that's really good. What I like to start with is, what do you value? What's important to you? And you may have built a company with a set of values. That doesn't necessarily mean those values are direct correlation with your personal values and what's important to you. A good example of this, there's a great company that was acquired, a lumber mill, and they were investing in the employees. And around the corner was a halfway house for people transitioning out of drug rehab. And the owners decided that it would be great because that drug rehab center, the halfway house, the biggest challenge those people had was reintegrating into society. So what if they played a role in that by providing work and providing the opportunity to train people up to be part of the lumber mill? And whether they stay with the company in the long term or not, that would be great. But obviously, if they want to move on to something different, that's also fine. But it helps integrate them into the workflow of the company. Now, that owner, when they come to sell, could say, I want to maximize the amount of money I sell this lumber company for, and then I'm going to give all this money away to people helping with rehabilitation. And maybe that's what I care about most. But if you actually dig into the issue, the big problem in that industry is finding companies that are willing to take a chance on these people trying to integrate into society, whether it's from drug addiction or from being in jail and transitioning back into society. We don't have enough companies to do that. So actually, the most value you can deliver to society is by finding the right partner who will continue that work, rather than taking away that source of work for that and that opportunity for that nonprofit. You keep that going by finding the right partner, and you're actually delivering on that value outcome, not by donating, but by being intentional about how you're selling the business and doing that. So I like to encourage them to think through what they value and those different areas of the business that are most important to them, and then think through the impact of different buyers to try and find the right fit. And that doesn't necessarily mean I'm the right fit. I'm a good fit for some organizations, but there might be another firm that's a better fit for other organizations. For me, I'm trying to help you avoid the regret of selling your business to the wrong person. And I was reading on DeepMind, one of the big AI players that was bought by Google, and just the regret of the founder of entering into that relationship with Google, because they had this big, lofty ambition of solving really big problems in the world and challenges in society. And the company ended up focused on selling more ads for Google. And that wasn't the original purpose of the company. But slowly over time, once they sold to Google, they had less and less influence on where they spent their time and how they invested that time. And therefore, the $600 million or whatever they sold the business for didn't look quite as good 10 years later in the position that they were in. And they might have been more willing to accept a slightly smaller paycheck in order to stay focused on their values and what they actually wanted to do in the world.
Wow, powerful example. Really powerful example. It happens to the little guy. It happens to the huge companies, and value is so important to establish. You better figure that out before you make major decisions. I want to ask you, because it seems the people that we bring to this show have such incredible expertise, perspective, vision. They're on important missions, aside from and along with being speakers that have gone out and taught this and are bringing their experience to the audience. I always like to ask someone, look, there's no getting there without some challenges. It's the easy journey is not the best journey. I'm sorry, it just isn't. We never, even in the storytelling market, nobody gets out and tells their fabulous success story, and actually nobody cares. What they want to hear is, how did you overcome what seemed impossible, but how did it make a difference? How did it shift and shape your next move? That's my big turn on. I love to hear that. Looking back on your journey, what's one lesson you really had to learn the hard way that now really guides your decision making?
For me, it's around thinking about the broader impact of the decisions you're making. Often we focus too much on one area or one stakeholder that gets impacted by something. About 3 years into my career at IBM, I was working on a massive cloud transformation project. And the project was not going well, Kelly. This one was being reported up to the top to the CEO every month because of the bad financial position it was in. And I was responsible for change management. So any changes to the scope of the project had to come through me and be approved by me. And I'd done that very successfully for 3 months. We'd passed through 30 changes without a problem. And then we passed through the 31st change and something went wrong. The big problem was I'd assessed the impact from our perspective, but I hadn't asked our partners what the impact was to them. And so far, we hadn't had a change request from the client that had impacted a third party in a way that would cost us money. But this change that I just approved and agreed with the client was now going to cost IBM several hundred thousand dollars to implement because the third party hadn't approved it and it was going to cost them more money. So as you can imagine, that was not the best situation to be in. And I wasn't feeling
big
great.
Yikes.
Yeah, we're working in the red and Andy's just added another $500,000 to the red. So I had to go to the lead partner and explain the situation and talk it through. And we managed to come up with a kind of agreement with the third party to mitigate a lot of the impact. But that taught me really well that I need to consider the impact to more than one person and not just ourselves when we're evaluating a decision. And that's something that I carry with me into everything that I do now. So I look at the business and I go, who is impacted by this business? There's not just customers and there's not just employees, but there's the community that company sits in. There's the suppliers that are helping provide that. They're all businesses and they're part of this broader ecosystem that is hopefully working together in a way that benefits everyone in that. If one partner decides to act and exploit and extract value from the other partners, that can drive that part of the ecosystem into the ground and destroy value in a very different way. And imagine being part of a business where you've raised your prices and squeezed your suppliers, and then three businesses in your local community that were supplying you go bankrupt. And then you have to live with that impact in your community. And when we think about it as a community and on a local level, we can evaluate those decisions and the impact in a healthier way than if those suppliers are in different countries or further away that we don't quite feel the impact in quite the same way, but it's still there.
What a great example of taking a bad decision. We make hundreds of decisions, thousands of decisions a year, but making a decision that doesn't work out well, look how it's impacted you and all the businesses you deal with in the future that benefited from that hopefully momentary failure or that one bad decision that really caused a lot of grief. But, you know, if you take that and turn it into something of great value for other people, then it's still on the right trajectory. It still changes the world. Nothing's perfect. Of everything that you've built, said and done, tell me what you're most proud of.
I used to work with a new grad and I was given a $50 million bid to run and asked to have this new grad on my program. And the reason that was a challenge for me is this person had been passed around project to project and had caused problems in every single project, but no one would give him any feedback. So he was ignorant around what he was doing wrong. But he had started to get a bit of a reputation for not delivering on his promises. So I accepted him into the project a little bit reluctantly, but I felt it was more important for me to see how he worked and be able to give him some actual feedback than it was for me to be completely successful on this project. I had other people with me as well, so I was confident we could still deliver. So a little bit of risk, but not a lot of risk. So we sat down together and we talked through some of this feedback I've heard. We set expectations, we agreed with those goals, and then we went out to deliver the project, the bid. He didn't deliver on what he set out to deliver, and he really struggled. But now I had a real life example, and we could sit down and talk it through. So several of us had to work weekends in order to get things over the line, in order to make up for it. But we went and had coffee, and we could talk through what happened, where my expectations were missed, and where I felt he'd let the team down. And that opened his eyes to what he could do differently, that really transitioned his career. And I worked with him a year and a half later on a live project, and he was a completely different person. And he delivered excellent value on that project. And that's not down to just me. That's down to his hard work over that year and a half in between those two projects. But someone taking the time to help them understand what they need to do in order to change and to grow and to be better. So I'm really proud of that. We've delivered a lot of great projects, but I'm really proud of helping people connect with the skills that they've got and develop them in a way that helps them be successful solving problems in the world.
Is that stunning to me? That was the choice of all the things that you could talk about. You've accomplished so much. And you're young. You've accomplished so much being on this planet. And that's the story that is so meaningful to you. That tells me a lot about who you are.
Yeah, that's what stays with me. That's what I look back on and go, yes, we had a win there. You can sell projects, you can deliver outcomes for other companies, but it's people that is really what is important and what we get a lot of satisfaction and joy out of, helping people and being able to connect what we do with the people that we're serving.
It certainly shows who you are. And I can't imagine that there aren't people listening to this. It's very thought-provoking to think of not only your perspective on success and how to transition out of a business, but and how to establish values, how to really look at your values before, now, and in the future. How's that all play out? I think it's incredible. And I really want to thank you for coming to this show today and sharing, giving us a look at what it really looks like to lead with integrity and carry someone else's vision forward and build something with soul. It wasn't just business talk. This was really a masterclass in legacy and purpose and the art of thoughtful leadership. We could talk for hours. In fact, you'll have to come back again. I'm so not done with you, is what I would say. Thank you for coming to this show.
It's an absolute pleasure. Thank you for letting me share your platform, Kelly, and share with your listeners a more purpose-driven way of operating in the world.
It gives me hope. It gives me joy to work with people like you and to be able to share your message out there. I think it's so needed. I think it's so timely. It's interesting. Everybody's very excited about AI. I'm certainly in AI and looking at it go from just being operational, being a tool and a resource, to how you can really work with it in partnership, but then how you teach it, it teaches you back. We become better. Hopefully values will be a big part of that. I think we need to program that in as well. And I think it can be, I think it's going to be needed, but this is an exciting time. But when it gets right down to it, you are about the human experience, mm-hmm. the human element. Yeah. I would say to everybody out there, if you want to learn more about Andrew and what he's building at Tree and Leaf Partners, head over there to his website. And if you're a founder who knows your business still has more life in it, but maybe not with you at the wheel anymore, go check him out. I think you need to have a conversation with him, because transitions, they don't have to be bad. They can be powerful. They can be impactful. They can be meaningful. They can be just that next step in the legacy that you leave. And I think that's really important. So this could be, if you're working with Andrew Galpin, this could be the beginning of a beautiful handoff. So Andrew's approach, it's just a living example too of how public speaking can be so important, not just to scale a message, but to create trust and rally people around a shared purpose and turn vision into movement. He doesn't just talk about it. Obviously, you can see he lives it. And to all of you out there, I hope you enjoyed this episode as much as I did. It's just simply not long enough. I'm sorry. I want more. If this episode lit you up in some way, please share it. Let us know. Send it to a friend. I hope you'll like this, because these are the kind of shows that just excite me so much to bring to you. and let us know. We love hearing what landed for you and what made you think differently, or even what made you laugh, what made you really ponder something in a different way. That's what this is all about. And that's how this show grows and how more entrepreneurs discover the insane power that public speaking has, not just on your revenue, but on your impact. And in the end, revenue is good for now. Impact is forever. A good place to put your focus. With that said, thank you everybody for being here. It is such a wonderful shared experience. I love it. And as always, I look forward to our next conversation. See you next time.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Six Figure Speaker Spotlight. We hope you enjoyed this deep dive once again into the remarkable stories and insights of our incredible guests. Their experiences and hard-earned, time-tested wisdom are not just meant to inspire you, but to provide you with actionable steps to take on your own path to success. Remember, you have a story to tell, and your voice has the power to transform your business and make lasting impact. And that's what it's all about. If you found value in today's episode, let us know, and I hope you'll take a moment and subscribe to The Spotlight wherever you listen to your podcasts, so you never miss a thought-provoking or idea-producing conversation. I'm Kelly O'Hara, and I can't wait to see you back here for the next episode of the Six Figure Speaker Spotlight.